The New Yorker's Andy Borowitz has been called one of the funniest people in America, and who am I to argue? He is back with his first book in 10 years. It is titled Profiles in Ignorance: How America's Politicians Got Dumb and Dumber. It examines the intellectual deterioration of American politics from Ronald Reagan to Dan Quayle, from George W. Bush to Sarah Palin, to, yes, Donald Trump. For over 20 years, Andy Borowitz has been skewering American politics and culture in his column, The Borowitz Report, a New Yorker staple since 2012, for which he won the first ever National Press Club Award for Humor. And unlike the column that made him famous, nothing in his new book is made up. Andy Borowitz joins us to talk about Profiles in Ignorance. How are you, dear friend?
I am so good. It's so great to hear your voice, Joe.
Very good to hear yours. I thank you very much for being with us. Congratulations on the new book. It's brilliant. I love it. And I assume that it has been a work in progress for a little while.
You know, it's been a work in progress in my mind. So many things are. Like, I think I've lived through a lot of these events because I'm a certain age, and so I've seen what's happened to American politics over the last 50 years. And I never said, I'm going to sit down and write a book about that. But then during the lockdown, I suddenly found myself with a lot of free time. I was looking for things to do. I played some Wordle. I'll admit it. I'm not too proud to admit that. I did some baking. But then I started thinking a little bit about how we got to the current state of American politics. And I really took it as almost like writing a college thesis. Like I went to the library, in this case, since we were locked down, I ordered a lot of books and I started reading a lot of nonfiction. And all this sounds very serious, except I've got to say, the book is a funny history book because of the people I'm talking about. You can't write a book where you're quoting heavily from Dan Quayle and Sarah Palin and have it not be funny. You're going to laugh.
Is Ronald Reagan, is that a good place to start?
It is. Or a bad place,
yeah,
depending on your historical perspective. Well, I wanted to ask this question very forensically. I wanted to ask this question, what did our politicians know? Because, you know, on the internet, if you disagree with somebody, you call them an idiot. That's just what we do. It's, oh, you're an idiot. Well, I didn't want to do any name calling. I wanted to find out what they knew and were they knowledgeable enough to be in government. And I found that over the last 50 years, we have had what I call the age of ignorance. And I divided it into three stages. The three stages of ignorance are ridicule, acceptance, and celebration. Ronald Reagan kicked off the ridicule phase. And in the ridicule phase, this was a time in the 1960s and 70s where, believe it or not, we still expected our politicians to be well-informed. We wanted them to know stuff. And so in that era, dumb or ignorant politicians had to pretend to be smart. So in 1966 in California, a bunch of Republican millionaires wanted to elect a Republican governor, and they'd been stymied because, you know, in 1962, they had this guy named Richard Nixon who ran and lost, and he said, you're not going to have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore. Unfortunately, he was not telling the truth at that point. But Nixon was bad on TV, and this was the era of people recognizing in the political world that it was really important to be good on TV, and the Nixon-Kennedy debates had shown that. So these millionaires said, let's reverse engineer this problem. Let's find somebody who's really good on TV and then, like, maybe teach him enough stuff about California that he seems like he could be a plausible governor. And their candidate was Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was tremendously ignorant. To give you an idea, I know he's been revered a lot in recent years and put up on a pedestal, but Ronald Reagan did not know that South America was composed of different countries. He could not divide 45 by 9. He thought that all the nuclear waste produced by a nuclear power plant in a year could be stored under a desk. So this is the kind of the kind of raw clay that they were dealing with, if you will. And they hired a guy named Stu Spencer, who was sort of the Henry Higgins to Ronald Reagan's Eliza Doolittle. And he saw what a mess Reagan was. And so he actually hired UCLA psychologists who did kind of a Clockwork Orange number on Reagan and just loaded him with all this information. And the good news was that because of his previous occupation, he was really good at memorizing stuff. So they put him out there, and he was convincing enough, and Ronald Reagan defeated a much more knowledgeable candidate, the incumbent governor, Edmund Pat Brown, by 1 million votes. And we've never looked back. From that moment on, the premise of American politics has been finding people who are good on TV, and that is more important than what they know. And Reagan was really the icon that got it started.
There's that scene in Back to the Future where there's one point in, and Michael J. Fox points, and they're in the 50s, and he points to TV, and he said, "That's our president." And the character says, "Ronald Reagan, the actor?" And I mean, I grew up in a Democratic household that was the response when Reagan ran was, "I'm sorry, what? An actor?" Now that just seems quaint.
Yeah, because it was a huge obstacle for Reagan. And he was, it's hard for people to remember this, but he was a tremendous object of scorn when he first ran for office. As a matter of fact, Jack Warner, one of these legendary studio bosses at Warner Brothers, when he was told that Reagan was running for governor, he said, "Reagan for governor? No. Jimmy Stewart for governor. Reagan for best friend." So that was the joke. He was a joke. He was a clown. And then he proved everybody wrong because he was an icon of the new era, the television age. He had the most important skill, which wasn't knowledge. It was performance. And we really are still living with that legacy today.
Then that follows through, right? I mean, some people have that quality who have become presidents since. Some of them haven't, but they've had other qualities. But the consistent seems to be the dumbness.
Yeah, I mean, the point is, what do we think is the most important thing? You know, in the ridicule stage, I had two guys who I was focusing on, Reagan and Dan Quayle. They were both equally ignorant. The difference was that Reagan was great at hiding it for the most part. I mean, you could also see through a lot of it too, but for the most part, he was good enough at hiding it that he fooled most of the people most of the time. Dan Quayle was terrible at hiding it. His ignorance was so glaring that they basically, the Bush campaign, he was the vice president on that ticket, they basically sent him off to Siberia in the fall. They did, you know, after his debate with Lloyd Benson, which was that train wreck where Lloyd Benson said, "You know, you're no Jack Kennedy." Right. That was the end of Dan Quayle as an active participant in that campaign. And you know, oddly enough, they both had the same tutor. They had this guy, Stu Spencer, who is like the Republican go-to guy who you'd bring in to train these ignorant politicians, didn't know anything. So that was ridicule. And the next phase that I discuss in the book is the acceptance phase. And this was a little bit different because we'd already been through this phase where dumb politicians had to pretend to be smart. In acceptance, dumb politicians realized, hey, being dumb and being ignorant actually makes me approachable and likable and the guy you want to have beer with. So instead of hiding it, I'm going to get out there and I'm going to kind of lead with my ignorance. And of course, I'm talking about George W. Bush, who made it his shtick that he never read anything, that he did badly in school. He was always talking about how he was a C student. And if you're a C student, you get to be president of the United States. It was the opposite of the Dan Quayle thing. Quayle and Bush were equally ignorant as well. I actually have a section in the book, a little quiz called Bush or Quayle. And then you have to test your knowledge to see who is who. They're very similar guys. They were these rich guys from the third generation of sort of genteel, you know, family wealth. And they both even belonged to the same fraternity in college, the DKE. And the difference is that poor Dan Quayle, when he didn't know the answer to a question, would be like a deer in the headlights and freak out and get very snippy, and it was a disaster. George W. Bush, if he didn't know the answer to a question, would really question the validity of being asked that question. He would say, why do I have to know something like that? You know, so he basically turned ignorance, which really had been potentially his Achilles heel, the way it was for Quayle, he turned it into a strength. It was the thing that made him a regular Joe, an everyday guy, a guy who is no different from you or me. Now, I, of course, as an elitist, say, I don't want a president who's just like me.
Right.
I want a president who's way smarter than me, because I would be terrible as a president. I don't know enough. So the idea that people like George W. Bush or his partner in crime in the acceptance phase, Sarah Palin, she's like a hockey mom. She's just like me. The fact that that was a strength was just weird. It was something that was new in American politics.
You have us then going into the celebration phase. So how do we celebrate it? That's just sort of rubbing your nose in it, right?
Well, the celebration phase, just to review for our class here, in ridicule, dumb politicians had to be smart, pretend to be smart. And in acceptance, dumb politicians could embrace how dumb they are. In celebration, which is the phase we're in now, even smart politicians who are super well-educated have to pretend to be dumb. So we have this really grotesque spectacle of people like Ron DeSantis,
right,
and Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, who are all Ivy League graduates, incredibly good students, who are openly embracing dumb ideas like Mr. Potato Head is like a really important issue in America. That's Ted Cruz. And Josh Hawley, who said that, you know, these votes shouldn't be certified, they're not legitimate, he knows that's not the case. And, you know, Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida, has appointed this complete quack as the Surgeon General of Florida. And this is a guy who is telling us all to take horse medicine. So that's where we are now. We're at a point where ignorance is valued so much more than expertise that you have these incredibly smart guys sort of shrouding themselves in ignorance in the hope that that will be a vote getter. And unfortunately, they've been right in a lot of cases, which is why they're continuing to do it.
Andy Borowitz is the author of the new book, Profiles in Ignorance, How America's Politicians Got Dumb and Dumber. So where does Donald Trump fit into this? Because I assume you wouldn't have the celebratory phase without Donald Trump coming onto the scene.
Well, Donald Trump, you can draw a direct line from Ronald Reagan to Donald Trump. They're both TV hosts. Their main talent, and by the way, drives the libs crazy when I say this, but Donald Trump is really talented on TV. He's one of the most successful TV stars in recent history. He was more successful on TV than Ronald Reagan was. And that has completely compensated and, in a way, made irrelevant the fact that he knows absolutely nothing. He's the most ignorant president we've ever had.
Right.
But it didn't matter to his fans and his voters, because he never made that the important thing. The important thing was you saw him on The Apprentice, and he really was such a, such a great capitalist titan. You never questioned the fact that he knew what he was doing. He just seemed like he was great at everything. And he was also saying all the things that you wanted to say but couldn't, but he was a billionaire, so he could get away with it. So the whole issue of knowledge and what he knows and what he's capable of was rendered irrelevant because his performance was so incredibly strong. And it does drive people crazy when I say that, because people hate Donald Trump and they're not willing to give him credit for anything. I give him tremendous credit for being good on TV. Very few people operate at that level that he can. Unfortunately, that doesn't contribute in any way to being a good president. His huge gaps in knowledge resulted in him sort of riffing nonsensically about things like, maybe we should all take bleach to get over the coronavirus, or maybe we should put light inside the body. No one has still explained to me what he meant by that, by the way. I understand how you drink bleach. I don't think it's a good idea, but I understand physically how that would happen. But he actually said, and I quote, what if you put light inside the body, which you can do? How?
Yeah.
How does that happen? Which you can, he stated as a fact, he never gave us any directions.
Now, that was a period where he was doing these 4:30, 5 o'clock daily briefings, telling us about the administration's attempts at combating the coronavirus. And that really showed, I mean, to me anyway, the ignorance, right? I mean, and I think even he said eventually, okay, these aren't working, because it was just, it was so unscripted, it was so odd, and it was starting, the shtick was starting to wear off.
Yeah, because he, as I said, he's really good. He understands the TV media medium. And he knew that he was in a really bad show. When I did the pilot, I thought this was going to be good. And now that it's gone to series, I realize this is like a terrible TV show. I mean, if you look at the way he approached those briefings, it was like he was on a TV show, because initially the stars of the TV show were like the doctors, right? It was Mike Pence. He put Mike Pence in front because he thought that he would, when in doubt, blame things on Mike Pence, as we later found out on January 6th. So he thought, oh, good, I'm going to stick this Mike Pence. But then he saw how huge the ratings were. It's like, hey, I want a piece of this. So he then shoved Mike Pence aside. He became the star of that show. And he saw how much juice like people like Fauci were getting, because Fauci could talk about science. So he was like, hey, I can do that. So I'm gonna spout some of my theories, like, let's everybody drink bleach and put light inside the body. And it just was a train wreck. But he wanted that to be a great TV show. It was just like, it was not The Apprentice. The Apprentice was a great show. The coronavirus briefings was a huge dud, huge dud. If you go onto his IMDb page, you know, say the short-lived coronavirus series was not a high point.
And just to realize that all of this comes full circle when the latest Bob Woodward book came out, and we learned that during January 6th and Vice President Pence didn't know what to do, he called up Dan Quayle.
Yes. Now, this is a very telling moment, because at this point in the Republican Party, where you've reached such a nadir of ignorance, suddenly Dan Quayle in 1988, who was universally regarded as the most ignorant politician in the country, is now the wise man of the Republican Party. He's the constitutional scholar. So, you know, he's Judge Learned Hand now. So Mike Pence, who is actually, I mean, Mike Pence has been unjustifiably turned into a hero of January 6th. He was actually calling Dan Quayle to see if there was any way that he could actually do what Donald Trump wanted him to do. It wasn't like he was saying, hey, I've got this maniac, how do I invoke the 25th right. Amendment? He was saying, I'm under all this pressure, what do I do? And Dan Quayle, and I give him credit in the book, very sensibly said, you have no choice. You have to do what the rules say. Talk to the parliamentarian. You just don't have a choice. So, yes, I will give Dan Quayle credit for being more moral than Mike Pence and possibly smarter than Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and the other people who are now the standard bearers of the Republican Party. But, folks, please, Dan Quayle is still Dan Quayle. He is still the man who said, and I quote, I have made good judgments in the past, and I have made good judgments in the future. He still is that man.
Now, where does this leave us, Andy? I mean, where are we now? We're going into the midterms, and yes. You just think, oh, God, because a lot of these, the people you just mentioned, the Marjorie Taylor Greens and so forth, we have more people that could be added to that club.
For those of you who think this is a book that makes you want to just hurl yourself out a window, I've heard this from people who've read it. It ends on a tremendously hopeful note, but it's hope that's born out of reality. It's not like crazy cockeyed optimism. Because what I talk about in the book is that I believe that democracy has a braking system. And what that means is that when people get too idiotic, yeah. The people that we've elected, we eventually say, enough. We've had enough. We can tolerate idiocy, as we've seen in the book. Like we elect ignorant people again and again. There comes that tipping point where someone goes too far, and we say, you know, even though we've tolerated all these people, we cannot tolerate you any further. And Joe, just in time for my book to come out, my theory has been borne out because, as you surely know, a couple of weeks ago, the voters of the great state of Alaska decided we will no longer tolerate Sarah Palin. And I thought that that was a really interesting moment. She was running for a congressional seat the Democrats never win.
Right.
And she lost. It was a pretty decisive loss for her. I'm not saying that we're always that eventually, you know, we're going to have a, you know, we're going to have a society here where we praise poets and philosophers. And, you know, we're all going to become very intellectual. You know, we'd be like the Left Bank in Paris. We're going to be sitting there smoking our cigarettes and talking about the existentialists. I don't anticipate that happening, but I do think that some of the recent election results, especially in these special elections in places like Kansas and Ohio, and moreover, most of all, Alaska, they show that history doesn't move in a straight line. We've been on this slippery slope for the last 50 years, a steady descent of the bar in terms of the knowledgeability of our candidates. And eventually, I do believe the breaking system of democracy kicks in. And it may be kicking in now, which to me, as a citizen of this country and someone with children, very, very exciting prospect.
Now, we wanted to make the case, didn't we, that an election of Joe Biden would be us putting the brakes on.
My view of Joe Biden, actually, and I wrote the book too early in his presidency to be able to make a lot of conclusions about Joe Biden. But Joe Biden, in a way, sort of confirms my thesis, because in that election in 2020, the Democratic primary was full of like these super brains, right? Like right. Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren was my candidate. Elizabeth Warren, remember I said an elitist is somebody who wants the president to be smarter than he is. Elizabeth Warren's definitely smarter than I am. So that's my choice for president. Ultimately, even though there were all these intellectuals in that field, you know, Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and Pete Buttigieg and Liz Warren, the Democrats nominated the guy who is not the smartest of that bunch or the most intellectual by a long stretch. They were really united in the idea that we were in an emergency situation and had to get rid of Donald Trump somehow. And he seemed, and he certainly turned out to be, the most electable. He's actually surprised me, because although I was not a fan of his in the primary, his achievements in the first couple of years are kind of undeniable. I mean, we have an infrastructure bill, which we had never had before. NATO has been reconstituted. I mean, he's achieved quite a bit, and that really has surprised me. So I have to give him credit for that. But again, like, history doesn't move in a straight line. Like, I thought when we elected Barack Obama, I thought, okay, great. Now all of our presidents are going to be like law school professors. You know, we're going to just have all these like super brains, and they're going to speak in complete sentences, and they're going to write critically acclaimed books. And that lasted throughout the presidency of Barack Obama. And then we went the other way. We always do this in America. We react. We went to the dumbest president in our history. So in a way, and I know it's counterintuitive, that's encouraging, because it says to me that as much as we have like the Boberts and the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the DeSantis's, and they grab all the headlines, that can't go on forever. Eventually, there's going to be a correction. And it may be happening now. Maybe the defeat of Sarah Palin is like the canary in the coal mine. Maybe that is a sign that, yes, better times are ahead.
Now you, sir, graduated magna cum laude from Harvard College. And I think it's very nice of you to say that you feel that there are people who are smarter than you. But you are a very smart human being. But you then go and sort of the way you have applied that is to write, for television initially, and then to entertain us, and then to sort of point out these things to us. And I'm just wondering if that's a good use of your talent.
Gosh, you know, have you been talking to my parents, Joe? I mean, that really sounds suspiciously like somebody texted you before the interview. Oh gosh, the question you've asked me essentially is, have I spent my life wisely or have I wasted it? And I think that's I guess where you grew up, that's a polite question to ask. I don't think that where I grew up, we were allowed to, in the Midwest, we didn't say, have you wasted your life on a radio show? But no, I understand your point. I actually think I have very modest expectations for how much I can achieve with any of the ability I have or any of the work I've done. It's like, I think that all we can do while we're here is maybe make the place incrementally better for a little bit of time. So like my attitude is like about comedy. I'm not one of these people who believes that like comedians are super powerful. I think that if in what I do, I can take some people from the depths of despair, like the people out there who want smart politicians and want a better government, but they're right now so depressed that they're lying in bed or they're just sitting on their couch and they're not doing anything about it. If I can use comedy to get them to laugh and maybe raise their serotonin level ever so slightly that they decide, hey, maybe I'm going to work at a phone bank or maybe I'm going to canvas, you know, in the fall or whatever. That's like at the high end of my expectations. I don't think I'm going to change a lot of people's minds because I think it's really hard to change people's minds. One of the hardest things in the world. But I think for those people who agree with me, my preaching to the choir and saying, come on, let's do this, that has like incremental teeny tiny value, which is that maybe I'll get some people to be inspired the way Stacey Abrams, you know, has been inspired to do such great things and really do the impossible. We talk about January 6th, but we don't talk much about January 5th, where Stacey Abrams and her volunteers got two Democrats elected to the U.S. Senate in Georgia, and they were an African-American and a Jew. I mean, this is like something out of sci-fi, what she achieved. And now Stacey Abrams, by the way, if you asked her that question, I will answer for her. She has not wasted her time on this planet. She's done a good job. But that's all I think. Like, I think like being a clown, being a comedian, you can maybe motivate people simply by cheering them up to the point where they take action. And they're not just in the slough of despond. They're not just in despair.
I asked this question. I don't know how you are going to take it, especially given my last question. But and it has really nothing to do with anything other than I don't know why this is the case. I think it's just my stupid brain. But when I was watching the Oscars and I saw what happened, I immediately thought of you because the way Will Smith came onto my radar was through Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which you created with your then wife. How do you process that?
You know, I guess the way I process it is that I've thought of the many, many different ways I could say no comment. And I right after that happened, actually, all the news networks, CNN, they all called me up. And sure. They all said, we've got to get you on TV to talk about this. And all I could think of was, how many people did they ask before they got to my name on the list? Was I like number 93 on the list? I just didn't think I was the most likely guy because I literally worked with Will Smith 32 years ago. We just actually, you know, on September 10th was the 32nd anniversary of the show premiering on NBC. So I guess my feeling is that when I was working with Will, he was like a 21-year-old kid and really eager to be a success because his career was kind of in a very bad position. He had been a successful rapper as a teenager, but that world had kind of moved on to more hardcore stuff because Will was very suburban and very soft and very likable. But, you know, the kids that had embrace that within a couple of years were like, no, we want to hear like Two Live Crew and things with Naughty by Nature. They were sort of over him. And so by the time I met him, he was unemployed and $1 million in debt. And the reason why he was in debt was because he'd like made $1 million, but no one told him that when you make $1 million, you're going to actually have to pay the government, you know, half of that. So instead, he spent it all on stuff like sneakers because he was like 17 years old. It was like he told me this story about how he and his friends, there was a new line of Nikes they wanted and it was not available in Philadelphia anywhere. So they chartered a plane, flew to Atlanta to buy sneakers and then flew back. So that was the way a 17-year-old would use $1 million. And very quickly, he ran through it. And he had this huge tax debt. So Will was just the sweetest kid and very vulnerable and really trying to make something of himself, because TV was kind of, at that point, seemed like his last chance. There was no sign that he was going to become this megastar. So now I look at Will Smith, and it's 30 years later, and I just don't know what Will is like. How could you go through the kind of megastardom that he's gone through without it having a huge impact on the way you see the Sure. world and how you see yourself? So as much as I do not endorse violence of any kind, especially in a national broadcast, I really think that's a... If ever there's a place where you should not hit somebody, yeah. it's there. But so I totally sympathize with Chris Rock, who's one of my idols, like one of the greatest comedians of all time. But as for Will, it's like, I certainly don't condone that act, but I also don't pretend to understand what is going on with him now. So I guess I have empathy for him too, because that didn't seem like a happy moment for him at all.
So comedically though, had it been anyone else who clocked Chris Rock, would it have been better for you? If you didn't have any backstory with the person who lunged onto the stage.
You know, that's really putting me in the position of condoning violence for the sake of a cheap joke that I might do later. So that doesn't, that won't reflect.
No.
That will not reflect well on me at all. So, no, I don't know. I don't want to hypothesize, but I mean, honestly, to tell you the truth, I was not watching the Oscars. I found the Oscars so boring and haven't watched it in years. And these Oscars were actually quite exciting, but not in the way that anyone at the Oscars would have liked. So it was sort of the law of unintended consequences. They've been trying to spice up the Oscars for years, and this year they were spiced up.
Yeah.
Not how to do it.
Do you? So you feel comfortable now with, let's say, not only writing about politics, but being able to skewer politics, and then that is a comfortable place for you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've been doing it for 20 years. You know, it's nothing I really set out to do. I mean, as you point out, I've done a lot of different things. I mean, I was a TV producer and writer for 15 years, and I spent like 10 years hosting Stories at the Moth, you know, which all NPR listeners know is like a big radio show now. Although I'm not involved in the radio show, but you know, I've tried to do a lot of things in writing. Just I've sort of followed what's interested me, and I think writing about politics really attracted me initially, just because the characters are so good. I don't mean good people. I mean interesting. And I think as a writer, you're always looking for, it starts with character, and that's true whether you're doing a TV show or whether you're telling a story at the Moth or whatever you're doing. You're looking for characters that are going to propel stories forward and hold your interest. And in writing this book, I just really got involved with the characters. I was very interested in people I don't agree with, but I was very interested in Ronald Reagan and Dan Quayle and Sarah Palin and George W. Bush and Donald Trump and the rest of them. I was interested in knowing their stories and how much they had been as kids interested in reading. It turns out none of them had. What was their approach to school? None of them liked school. I mean, there were these through lines that kept emerging. So, you know, it's funny, you know, I've done different things, but everything is, all writing is related. When I was writing for sitcoms, it was all about, you know, creating characters and drilling down and then trying to understand what a character wanted and how a character would behave. And the same is true here with like nonfiction. It's like first time I'd written a nonfiction book, but I approached them all with that same point of view, which is like, okay, what do they want? What were the things that motivated them? What were the things they were interested in? How do they react to things? And, you know, the results in these cases were, you know, very dire for the country. They were funny in a macabre sense, I guess is the word, but none of them ever paid attention in school, and we as a country paid the price. So there was one review of the book I really liked where the guy said that the book makes you laugh, cry, and swear all at the same time. And I think that that's probably a really good assessment of the rational response to
yeah,
these stories.
I'd be happy with that. Yeah, that sounds great. You know, the one outlier, and I'll end with this because I neglected to bring this name up when we were talking about the book specifically, but Where does Barack Obama, the outlier here?
Well, Barack Obama's in the book. I don't talk about him right. at length, but he wasn't totally immune to this trend, in that he's a very, very brilliant guy, one of our smartest and best educated presidents. But he did feel, for political purposes, that he had to kind of play that down. I mean, as much as we think of like the soaring oratory of Barack Obama, it was more soaring at the beginning of his campaign than at the end of it. By the end of it, he was saying things like fired up, ready to go, and hope and change. And he had kind of watered it down to a much more simplified rhetoric, to the extent that, I mentioned this in the book, Samuel L. Jackson, the noted actor and star of Snakes on a Plane, actually criticized Obama. He's a big Obama supporter, but he said, "You're dumbing things down. Be effing presidential." And I love that critique coming from Samuel L. Jackson. But he's also a very smart guy. But his whole point of view is, like, when I talk the way I do because I'm with friends and I'm being casual and I'm being a little profane. But you're the president of the United States. You should be eloquent. I think what Obama did very skillfully was he was, in fact, a brilliant guy. And he has so much talent as a politician, really the most talented politician I think in my lifetime, that he was able to kind of thread the needle. And he had to thread so many needles. I mean, he was the first African-American president, which was maybe the biggest needle he had to thread. Like, how do you overcome people's racism or, you know, fear of the other? And, you know, honestly, he did the best anyone could do with that. There were certainly a lot of people whose reaction to him was just straight up racist. There was no way he was going to overcome that. And the election of Donald Trump was, in a way, for a lot of people, a manifestation of that. He, I think, in a way, is kind of the Goldilocks, you know, golden mean in this, which is, if you can find somebody who's that brilliant, but also that talented and can read the room as well as Barack Obama does, you're golden. I mean, that's what everybody wants to elect. The problem is Barack Obama's, you know, do not come around every election cycle. Very rare. There's only been one in my lifetime. So
right.
That's where he fits. He is totally an outlier, but he managed to make it all work. I sort of stand back in awe at that. Not everything he did was perfect, but given the hostility to him the entire time he was in office, not just from the Republicans, but from the Tea Party activists and all the people like Donald Trump, the birthers, the people claiming he wasn't born here, the fact that he kind of kept his head down and got Obamacare into the law books, that has saved many, many lives. People like to pick apart Obama's legacy, but talk to a cancer survivor who got his or her treatment because of Obamacare, and you'll get a little bit of a different story.
Andy Borowitz's new book is Profiles in Ignorance: How America's Politicians Got Dumb and Dumber. It is published by Avid Reader Press. Andy, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. The book is delightful, as are you, and I thank you very much for spending time with us.
Oh, and thank you, Joe.
Be well. Again, the name of the book is Profiles in Ignorance. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.